Insurance isn't one size fits all, and shopping for it shouldn't feel like squeezing into something that doesn't fit. That's why drivers have enjoyed Progressive's Name Your Price tool for years. With the Name Your Price tool, you tell them what you want to pay, and they show you options that fit your budget. Enough hunting for discounts, trying to calculate rates, and tinkering with coverages. Maybe you're picking out your very first policy, or maybe you're just looking for something that works better for you and your family. Either way, they make it simple to see your options. No guesswork, no surprises. Ready to see how easy and fun shopping for car insurance can be? Visit progressive.com and give the Name Your Price tool a try. Take the stress out of shopping and find coverage that fits your life on your terms. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Summer adds up fast. You take a little trip there, head out for a nice little dinner there, get a nice coffee every hour, and before you know it, you're struggling to keep up. That is where Chime comes in. Chime's not like traditional banks, which love to gatekeep the best rewards and pile on hidden fees, unless you've got a massive balance. Chime offers the most rewarding banking. No overdraft fees, no monthly fees, no minimum balance fees, nada. You get 5% cash back on your Chime card in a category of your choice. You can also grow your money faster with a savings rate that's 9 times the national average. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free with America's number one choice for banking. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded. Sign up now. It only takes a few minutes. Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services and Chime card provided by Chime's bank partners. Qualifying direct deposits required. Terms and limits apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
I'm Saruti.
I'm Hannah.
And welcome to Red Handed. Did we talk about the book again? I feel like we're just never going to be able to not talk about it.
Yeah, fucking plug the book for the rest of our lives. For at least the next year, I feel like we have to plug that book.
I feel like we should talk about the book for as long as it took to write, which was about a year. So, sorry, guys. But no, seriously, we are just so, like, moved by the incredible response that we've had from all of you, everyone who signed up. Our publishers are like, this is amazing, we're so excited, and we're so excited. I know that September feels like a really, really long time away, but it's really not. And also, pre-orders are massively helpful. So if you are even on the fence about buying the book, if you're thinking maybe I'll just wait till September, please don't. Please go take a look at the book now. Yeah, just pre-order it, probably. That'd be nice of you.
Definitely. I think just help us out. It makes us look good. It makes our lives easier. So just please, please pre-order the book. It's a good deal for everyone. Everyone wins.
Exactly. And we're going to keep saying this because it's true. We worked so, so, so hard on the book. And we're honestly just so excited for you all to read it. I don't think anyone's going to be disappointed. We learned so much writing this book. And considering we've been doing true crime professionally, I suppose, for 4 years, and we learned that much. Honestly, we just feel like this is a journey of true crime discovery that you can come on if you buy this book.
But you have to pre-order it, otherwise you're not allowed it.
Exactly. So that's all we'll say, for now, at least, on the matter of the book, because we've got a case for you guys. And yeah, it's quite the case, so let's get on with it. On the 30th of March 2005, people walking past the Royal Canal in Dublin were starting to feel a bit uneasy about what they saw bobbing around in the water. It must just be a mannequin, they told themselves as they hurried on their way. But this wannabe mannequin became harder to ignore when a leg popped up with a sock still clinging to a clearly putrefying foot. Today's story, as I said, is quite the case. It is possibly one of the most notorious murder investigations in modern Irish history, sending shockwaves around the nation when it unfolded.
And our most requested of for quite some time, I would argue.
Oh, absolutely.
You've been gagging for this one, you lot.
Definitely. Very, very, very highly requested case. The judge who presided over the subsequent trial even described this as, quote, the most grotesque killing that had occurred in his career. So strap in, because it's going to be a bumpy and very bloody ride.
But before we find out what you all really want to know about the body in the canal, we need to go back 10 days before it was discovered. We have to go back to the 20th of March 2005. It was the day before 21-year-old Charlotte Mulhall's birthday, and she'd just woken up in her dad's house in Talla. Talla is... it's on the southwest edge of Dublin. Charlotte was bored. She wanted to go out and start drinking. It was her 21st birthday the year before, and it had been totally shit, because following a massive bender, she ended up in a depressive state for weeks. So she really wanted to make sure her 22nd birthday was a bit more of a laugh. Spoiler, it won't be.
But of course, Charlotte wasn't to know what nightmare scenario was about to play out over the next 24 hours. So when she got a call from her mum, Kathleen, asking if she wanted to meet up in town, Charlotte was pumped. She quickly ran across the hall into the next room to tell her older sister, Linda, to get dressed. But 30-year-old Linda wasn't keen. To say that she'd had a very rough time of it lately would be putting it incredibly mildly. Linda had four children, but a few months back, her abusive piece-of-shit boyfriend, Wayne Kinsella, had been sentenced for abusing her kids, and as a result, they had all been taken into care. During this time, Linda had spiraled. She'd become hooked on heroin and started drinking heavily. And when we say heavily, apparently, Linda was known to knock back up to 3 bottles of vodka a day.
That's going some. Although I did read the other day that, you know, like whatever the suggested amount of units we're supposed to be drinking is, it's completely made up because everybody lies about how much they drink. So like there is no way of actually knowing as a nation how much we drink and how much the human body can take because nobody tells their doctor how much they actually drink. So it's all completely made up.
Yeah, I can imagine that the data that the government has on how much we're drinking is definitely made up. But I think that scientists definitely know how much we can drink, like how much your liver can like metabolize in an hour. I don't think that it is 3 bottles of vodka a day.
No, I think by anyone's standards, that's quite a lot.
It is very much so, apart from some of the other people in this story, as we will go on to find out. So following this incredibly difficult time in Linda's life, she had just moved back in with her dad to try and sort herself out. She really wanted to get her kids back, and it had only been a few weeks since she'd got one of her sons put back in her care.
But Charlotte wasn't having it. It was her birthday eve, and they were going out. So Linda reluctantly left her son with one of their brothers, and the pair jumped on a bus and headed into the city centre, where on O'Connell Street they met their 49-year-old mum, Kathleen, and her 38-year-old Kenyan boyfriend, Farah Swala Noor. The group didn't have much money. All of them were on welfare, and no one had the spare cash to hit the pub for €5 pints. So instead, they ended up in an off-licence and bought a large bottle of vodka and some Cokes. They mixed the drinks and set about wandering around the city, drinking and chatting. Year 9 behaviour.
Very much so. Very much so. There is a documentary out there that you can watch on this case. It's just like on YouTube, and I think it's just called The Scissor Sisters. Considering all the shit that goes down in this episode, I do understand, but they are like super judgy about the fact that these people are just like drinking on the street. And I really tried to find out if it's illegal to drink on the streets in Dublin. And I really couldn't figure out what the answer was. So I didn't want to commit to saying one way or the other. Especially, I don't know what the case was at the time this was happening. But I was like, some really fucking horrible shit goes on here. And you're spending like 5 minutes of this documentary being like, well, they didn't go to a pub or a bar. They were just drinking on the street. And I was like, if you're drunk, you're drunk. Like, it's not great, but like, context.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it all before, how like in England and Wales, like Scotland, the drinking outside rules are very, very strict. But England and Wales, you can basically do what you want. Unless, you know, it's behind the wheel of your car, you can't really drink there. But other, everywhere else is completely fine. But it's kind of like, you know, like in Peep Show, where he's having a picnic and then ends up on the news, like swigging lager in a park. Like, I just think there are worse things than drinking on the street. I really, really do.
So during this day out drinking, the group headed down to what's called the Spire. And I haven't actually been to Dublin, so I did have to Google what this is. It's like a monument, it looks like, in the city centre. That's what I've discovered. So they're walking down to this spire. And at this point, Charlotte decides that the giant bottle of vodka isn't quite enough, and she pulls out a bag of ecstasy tablets. Bear in mind that this is like the morning time. This is like they've just got up and then head immediately into town to start drinking, and she pulls out these ecstasy tablets.
That's a snapshot of their lifestyle, I think.
Yes, absolutely. I think that is something to be made very clear. Yes, it may be Charlotte's like birthday eve, but this is like quite typical of this group. And unfortunately as well, like there is a lot of deprivation in the area that we're talking about. What they were doing in terms of drinking, getting up and starting drinking quite early, taking drugs, wandering around town like this, it doesn't seem to have been a particularly eyebrow-raising thing for most people that they knew. It was just like part and parcel of life. So she pulls out these ecstasy tablets and she, her sister Linda, and her mum Kathleen all take one.
Dropping ecstasy with my mum is not something on my list of life experiences. Pass on that one, thank you.
No thanks.
I know it's like a lifestyle thing, but like the thought of like having a come down on your birthday is probably the worst thing I can possibly imagine. I mean, I'm presuming her intention is to just keep going for a few days.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When they get started, they go for days. That's the way that they like manage it. So the three women take the ecstasy tablets and they didn't offer any of the drugs to Farah because he had been on a bender for 3 days straight by this point. And they also knew that Farah, when he went too far on the party train, could become very nasty and aggressive. And since he was currently on good form, they decided that they wanted to keep him that way. And so they kept the drugs to themselves. And over the next few hours, all three women took two more ecstasy pills each, while they're also polishing off this bottle of vodka. So now drunk and high and all out of vodka, the women decided to head home. So they all went to flat 1, 17 Richmond Cottages, in nearby Ballybock, where Kathleen and Farah had been living for the last few months.
Ballybock literally means poor town in Irish. Like, that is the literal translation. I think that someone was trying to campaign to get it changed or whatever. Like, it's a deprived area and always has been, so you can tell by the name. The whole situation with Kathleen Farah and Kathleen's family was a complicated one. Kathleen and John Mulhall, Charlotte and Linda's dad, had been married for almost 30 years, and in total they had 6 children together, but the relationship had been a very difficult one. John had been highly abusive towards his wife, and both of them had serious drinking and substance abuse issues. Growing up, Linda, Charlotte and the other 4 Mulhall kids had been surrounded by deprivation, violence, alcohol and drugs. It was as far from a stable home life as one could hope for. Almost all of the children dropped out of education at a young age and struggled with their own mental health and substance issues. Linda went through a string of abusive relationships, and as a teenager, Charlotte turned to street-level sex work to feed her addictions. In 2002, it seemed that Kathleen had finally had enough. She met Farah and decided to leave her husband and 6 children to be with him. Obviously, by this point, her kids weren't kids anymore. But Linda took her parents' split very badly. She hated Farah, and she, like her dad, was furious with her mum for abandoning the family. John seems to have been particularly angry that Kathleen had left him for a younger black man, something he made clear in the various threats he threw at Farah. And so, worrying that John might be true to his word, Farah and Kathleen had actually left Dublin for over a year and moved to Cork. But after Farah seemed to run into a bit of trouble down there with some scary people, the pair had returned to Dublin.
It's never made clear, like, who he has a run-in with, but they just come back and say that he got in trouble with, like, some men from the IRA or something, and that's why they came back to Dublin.
Yeah, there are some scary people in Cork.
And it seems like Farah was very good at finding the most scary people wherever he was and having run-ins with them. So now that we understand the history of this group a little bit better, let's get back to their big day out. Farah, Kathleen, Linda and Charlotte were all now back in the flat in Ballybock, where the drinking and the drugs continued. Kathleen, clearly forgetting the let's not get Farah too crazy rule, crushed up an ecstasy pill and put it in Farah's drink without him noticing, because she wanted him to perk up a bit. If I want my friend to perk up a bit, probably wouldn't drug them with ecstasy without them knowing. Maybe just, you know, put on a fun film.
Putting on a fun film isn't going to get you hyped to go out, though. Like, maybe what they do next, actually, is how I get hype.
I mean, yes, they're fully on the party train. But the problem is, the reason that Farah probably wasn't quite as perky as maybe Kathleen would have liked was, like we said, he'd been on a 3-day bender, and by this point he had been drinking solidly for 12 hours straight. He's completely wrecked. They all are, but him especially. But the party continued anyway. They turned on some Sean Paul, poured some drinks, and generally, the vibe was pretty positive and upbeat.
It's impossible not to dance to Sean Paul. It's impossible to be in a bad mood listening to Sean Paul. I challenge anyone.
I mean, you say that, but I believe that Sean Paul is on the entire time the next part of this story unfolds.
Oh, no, don't tell me that. You can't ruin it for me. Sean DePaul, what am I going
to
do?
Bit of Sean DePaul in the back while all this horrible stuff is about to go down. So I don't know, that is a bit tough to take, but let's go with it. So, you know, things are looking good. Things are looking like, you know, everybody's in a good mood. Everybody's having a drink. Everybody seems pretty chill despite polishing off. She had a bag of 10 ecstasy tablets. And that one that Kathleen crushed up and put in Farah's was the last one. So the women have likely taken 3 each and Farah has taken 1 in the space of like a few hours. But the good mood was swiftly brought to an end by Farah. He staggered over to the sofa that Linda was sat on and started to put his arm around his girlfriend's daughter. He then began to rub her leg and her back. At this point, Linda freaked out and yelled at him to stop. But Farah just grabbed her and pulled her closer to him, whispering in her ear, and this is a quote according to Linda, "We are two creatures of the night."
Nope. I can't imagine ever having a positive response to that sentence.
No, I didn't even know how to say it for dramatic effect. What is even the tone? What is even the inflection one puts on that sentence? We are just two creatures of the night. Come here. I don't know. It's horrific. And obviously, Linda is not game at all, and she begins to yell. And her mum and her sister, who were in the kitchen, came running in. Despite this, though, Farah continued. And it's like he carries on as if he and Linda were the only two people in the room. He just completely ignores his girlfriend, Kathleen, and Charlotte. And he carries on by telling Linda, "You look so much like your mammy," again and again, as he gropes her.
And, like, her mammy is right there.
Yep.
Bizarre. Now, Linda, Kathleen, and Charlotte were all just yelling at Farah, but he continued to pour at Linda, grabbing her by the waist and trying to kiss her. Charlotte was raging. Although she was the younger of the two sisters, she had always been very protective of Linda. Linda was the more naive of the pair, and Charlotte, who, like we said, had been working as a sex worker since her late teens, was a lot more street smart and tough than Linda was. So Charlotte started pulling Farah off Linda, and he eventually let go, but turned around with a crazed look in his eyes, screaming that he was going to kill Kathleen. Not to undermine the fucked upness of the situation with this man threatening their mum, but this was pretty typical of Farah and Kathleen. If Kathleen had left her husband John Mulhall for a better life with Farah, she was sorely disappointed. Farah had been just as aggressive and abusive as John, and screaming arguments and physical abuse were all too common at flat 117 Richmond Cottages.
So let's take a quick moment to get better acquainted with Farah Sawale Noor. Farah had arrived in Ireland on the 30th of December 1996 at the age of 31. He had come to Dublin hoping to start again, but right from the off, the lies began. Farah Sawale Noor claimed that he was from war-torn Somalia and that his wife and children had all been killed and that he needed political asylum. None of this, however, was true. Firstly, he wasn't Somalian. Farah was a Kenyan national, and his wife and children were all very much still alive and living in Mombasa. And just to top it off, his name wasn't even Farah Sawale Noor. It was Shalila Said Salim. But eventually, in 1999, Farah was granted the right to stay while his refugee application was being processed. He got himself odd jobs and temp work, and quickly settled into his new life in Ireland. But Farah, as we will go on to see, was a real piece of shit. There is no other way to describe him than as an alcoholic, abusive predator, because he spent most of his time going after young, vulnerable women and girls. He entered into numerous violent relationships with teenagers and girls with learning difficulties. He even got one girl, Paula, pregnant, and then he told her he wanted nothing to do with it. Paula and Farah were together for a number of years, and during that time, she reported him multiple times to the Gardaí for rape, domestic abuse, and threats of murder. But she still struggled to leave him.
During this time, in 1999, Farah Noor even found himself at the heart of one of Ireland's most infamous unsolved murders. I feel like every time we do an Irish case, it just feels like there are no murders in Ireland kind of almost ever. Like, I feel like every time we come across it, it's like the most infamous or the most spectacular, or it just feels like Irish people don't kill each other that often, which is, of course, not the case. But this one is the killing of 17-year-old Reinaid Murray. Reinaid was walking home from the pub on the 4th of September 1999 when she was having an argument with a man at around 11:55 p.m. Her body was found soon after, and horrifically, Reinaid had been the victim of a brutal attack. This murder sparked an enormous manhunt in Ireland. 50 detectives worked on the case, and 8,000 people were interviewed. And Farah came into the picture because he was in the area on the night, and he had a propensity towards violence against women. He collected knives, and he would often drunkenly boast about having been the killer. He was interviewed by Gardaí during their investigation, but there was no solid evidence to link him to the murder. And to this day, the killing of Reinaid Murray remains totally unsolved.
In 2003, Farah then met and got into a relationship with Kathleen Mulhall. And right from the beginning, just like all of his other relationships, it had been a violent one. Farah raped Kathleen multiple times, and on several occasions he had beat her so badly that she had ended up in hospital. So as you can see, Farah had form for extreme violence. And this is why we say it wasn't particularly out of the norm once he started threatening Kathleen that day. But this time, watching him, Charlotte snapped. She walked into the kitchen and grabbed a Stanley knife that had been sitting on the counter. For everyone else, a Stanley knife is like a box cutter.
There's something about it that just sends a... It's probably to do with Breaking Bad, to be honest, but there's just something about hearing Stanley knife or box cutter that just makes me feel on edge.
Hate it, hate it. So she walks back into the living room with this Stanley knife, where Farah was still shoving her mum. And according to Charlotte, Kathleen saw her and yelled at her, "Kill him for me. If you don't, I'll be dead by the end of the year." So Charlotte grabbed his head, pulled it back, and slit Farah Sawale Noor's throat. Farah clutched his bleeding neck. His eyes were wild, staring in disbelief. He staggered into the bedroom as the blood gushed from the 4-inch deep wound. He tried to fall on the bed, but he slipped and hit his head on the edge of the bed frame, falling onto the floor.
He called out for Kathleen, calling her Katie, his pet name for her, and begged for help. But Charlotte wasn't done. She followed Farah into the bedroom and once again slit his throat to make him stop yelling. But Farah still wasn't dead, and as he tried to get to his feet, Linda, who had found a hammer, walked in and let out a scream and smashed the tool over the bleeding man's head. The sisters then continued to attack Farah as he lay unconscious on the floor. Charlotte and Linda were in a frenzy. They stabbed Farah over 22 times, and Linda repeatedly pounded at Farah's head with the hammer. She hit him so hard that she left deep hammer marks indented on the floor. Eventually, after Farah was long dead, the sisters stopped, and the realization of what they had done hit them. Quite Michael Alec-esque, really.
It really is. And I think that, you know, you have to take into account that these women, and I'm not, this is not me at all excusing what happened, but they've taken probably 3 ecstasy tablets within maybe as many hours and drunk at least a quarter of a bottle of vodka. And they were drinking at the house before they even went and met their mum and Farah in town. So God knows how much they'd actually had to drink that day. It's a bit like when we talked about in the Suzanne Capa case years ago, that idea of like drug-induced psychosis. That is never proven in this. I don't think anyone even looked at that possibility, but it feels very much like they just completely lose their minds and just go for it and just attack him. Because when we say that Linda hit him so hard with the hammer again and again and again, that when she misses and she hits the floor and she leaves dents in the floor, this is a flat with like concrete floor under the carpet. She's like fucking chipped at the floor how hard she's hit him. So when they were done with the attack, Linda and Charlotte walked back into the living room where their mother was sitting quietly. Kathleen hadn't come into the bedroom while the attack was taking place, but she clearly knew what had happened. And it's also important to say that Kathleen never made an attempt to try and stop the women doing what they were doing. So clearly on edge and in complete shock, the women knocked back a few more vodkas to gather themselves. Then Kathleen turned to her daughters and asked them how they planned to get rid of the body. And the thing is, we have to say, with this account of what happens, all of the women say different things, but this is the version that Charlotte and Linda both kind of agree upon later. So that's what we're kind of going with. And Linda would later tell the Gardaí that it had been Charlotte's idea, but Charlotte claimed that it was her mum who had said that they should just chop Farah up and chuck him in the canal. Whoever's master plan it was Linda and Charlotte who dragged Farah's body from the bedroom into the flat's tiny bathroom. There they propped up the already mangled corpse in the shower cubicle, and then, with just a bread knife, the Stanley knife, and the hammer, they began to cut the body into pieces.
Notably, at no stage are there scissors.
No. There's never any scissors.
Everyone calls this the Scissor Sisters. There's no scissors. There are no scissors involved. Stanley Knife Sisters sounds just as good, in my opinion.
Yeah, they should have been the Stanley Knife Sisters, the Bread Knife Babes. I don't know.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Very good, thank you. There's never any scissors, as far as I could tell, from all the research I've done this week.
The Hammer Hermanas, make it Spanish.
But, like, can we just take a second? We're going to go into, like, what they specifically do to the body, and it's all very horrible. Please stop eating. No eating warning starting now.
No, you perverts, stop it now.
Yes, please. But they dismember. Spoilers. But they dismember an entire human body with a fucking bread knife, a Stanley knife, and a hammer. I mean, how?
That is conviction and fortitude.
Yes.
There's determination, if I've ever seen it.
Absolutely. Because I think at this point, in the documentary, they say, you know, that after they had killed Farah, maybe they could say that it was just, you know, a drunken crime of passion. They did it because of the years of abuse that they had endured throughout their lives. And then seeing him being abusive towards their mum had just pushed them over the edge. But I think there was a point there where they could have been like, okay, do we just confess? Do we just hand ourselves in? Or do we try and get away with this? They're clearly very committed to trying to get away with this. And I think the clear motivation, obviously, is no one wants to go to jail. But Linda, who is often described as the more naive one, the quieter one, all of this, she really takes a lead in all of this. But I think her motivation is she doesn't want to be taken away from her kids or have her kids go back into care. Again, also, people just don't want to get caught for murder. So what do I know?
It's a pretty strong motivator in a lot of cases we've covered. Precisely. Not wanting to go to prison.
So a lot of what we're about to tell you next about what went down comes from the book The Scissor Sisters by Mick McCaffrey. And there are some truly horrific descriptions. Basically, he's like, this bathroom is so tiny, the shower cubicle is so tiny, they prop Farah up in there, but they can't get his legs inside. So they start by amputating his legs.
Just like Michael Alec. Like, maybe there's like any sort of drug-crazed body dismemberment is legs first. Maybe there's some sort of pattern.
Drug murder logic. I don't know. I didn't put this in the notes, but basically the way that Mick McCaffrey describes the way that they did a lot of the dismembering was by putting this rather blunt bread knife underneath the limb they wanted to amputate and then just smashing at it with a hammer from above.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose sawing through it wouldn't have worked. So they kind of have to 27 hours him, 127 hours. Is it 127 hours?
I think so. 27 hours doesn't sound long enough.
No, it doesn't sound long enough to break your own arm off, does
exactly.
It?
I just probably wait another 100 hours.
Spoilers, by the way. That's what happens. I thought that film was the most boring piece of shit I've ever seen in my life. Don't bother.
No, I've seen it. It was, watch something else. Just watch anything else.
Don't waste your time. Watch paint dry. It's literally the same experience and you don't have to pay for it. The bathroom quickly became absolutely saturated in blood. It was everywhere. And the two women were also soaked from head to toe in the congealing blood and human matter. Charlotte and Linda worked through the night hacking up the body, but there was just so much blood that it soon stopped even draining away. So periodically, one of them would have to stop and use a towel to push the blood down the plug hole. They also had to use their hands to clear the drain because it kept getting blocked with bone and flesh. Once they'd cut off the arms and legs, the sisters decided that they had to remove Farah's head. If his body was found, his head would identify him straight away, and they couldn't take that risk. So Linda placed a towel over the head and began to dislocate it from the neck using the hammer. I have no idea how she managed it, but Linda eventually decapitated Farah's head from his body. But she wasn't done. Suddenly, Linda grabbed Farah's penis and cut it off with a Stanley knife, saying, "Now you'll never rape my ma again." I don't think he would have been able to do it with his head off either. I don't think that was the key factor. We moved into our office today, and I'm recording this sat in a WeWork, and I'm very glad that we seem to be the only people on this floor, because Seth's got headphones on, I don't think he can hear me, but I'm like, can anyone else hear me? What happens when people move into the office next door? Then what?
They're just going to have to become fans of Red Handed. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So once the work was done, and again, you're right about the level of commitment. They work all night to chop his body up because they're so ill-equipped with like just a fucking bread knife that they've got. So once they were done, the sisters went back into the living room where their mum Kathleen was sat watching TV. I mean, there is just such a level of kind of disconnect at points in this case from like reality. And I don't know, I don't want to like bias everybody immediately, but I've sat with this case for for a week now, and I really can't help but just feel like everyone in it is awful but Kathleen. I know she's a victim of abuse at the hands of all the men she's ever been with, but like, I don't know, just sitting and watching TV while your children are chopping up a body of a man they murdered. What? At this point, the women very much decided that they could get away with this if they were careful. Farah was known to be a vanisher. They could just say that he'd run off with another woman, or that he'd got in trouble again with the wrong people and legged it. After all, he didn't have any family in Ireland, and the women were sure that no one would even notice he was gone. And if they did, they wouldn't think it was that odd. So, the main issue now was disposing of the body and cleaning the bloody flat. But there was just so much to get rid of. Farah had not been a small man. They couldn't very well just carry his body parts out in bags. Where would they even put it? Secondly, all of his stuff was in the flat. If they were going to say that he'd just run off, they'd have to get rid of all of that too. Then there was the state of the flat itself. Almost everything was completely soaked in blood, including huge chunks of carpet. The women considered just tearing everything up and just chucking it in the bin. And we've actually seen before on this show that sometimes just dumping evidence like that isn't such a bad plan, because it just gets taken off to the dump and vanishes into the mounds of rubbish.
Bob Bardella got away with it for years.
Exactly. But the problem was that there was still 3 days until the next bin collection, and they didn't feel like they could just dump everything in there and wait all that time for it to be taken away. The women needed help. None of them could drive, and none of them had a car. So they called John Mulhall.
When John arrived at the flat, wondering what on earth they had called him over about, Farah's body bits were already packed up in black bags piled up in the hallway. The stench of sweat, blood and bleach hung thick in the air, and his daughters were still soaked in blood. Before John could even ask what had happened, Kathleen informed him that Farah was dead and that the girls had killed him. John couldn't bear it, and he left. Now, feeling truly on their own, Linda and Charlotte got to work scrubbing the flat from top to bottom. They cleaned everything, and even cut out strips of the carpet in the bedroom where Farah had bled to death. They had to get everything spotless. This flat was where Farah lived. If he was reported missing, it's where the Garda would come first.
As they were elbow deep in blood and bleach, suddenly the door rang. It was John. He had reluctantly come back to help his daughters. Two of their sons were already in jail, and he didn't want Linda and Charlotte to end up there too. So John loaded up Farah's clothes, the knives, and the various other blood-soaked items into his work van and left to dispose of them. This just left the three women to deal with the body parts. So Linda and Charlotte packed the black bags full of Farah into gym bags and walked to the Royal Canal. And just, it's not the smartest move, as we'll go on to discover for various reasons, but one of those reasons is that the Royal Canal is just a 3-minute walk from their flat. It's like outside. Guys, no. What are you doing? And the other thing is, the water at the point of the canal where they dump the body or body parts is only 8 foot deep. That's like actually nothing.
If there was two Cerriti standing on top of each other, it would be taller than 8 foot, wouldn't it?
Yeah, Yeah.
So two Cerutis is taller than that, which is not very tall.
No, it's not very tall. Well, it would be 10 foot if I was standing on top of myself, but it's not very deep at all. You're right. They're doing this in the daytime as well. That's another thing worth pointing out. And it also took them multiple trips to dump all of the remains. And the Garda would later find CCTV showing them dumping the body. I mean, like, I don't know. I guess at this point, they still continue to drink, like, while they're cleaning the flat and everything. So I just don't think they're ever not drunk or high during this entire incident.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think murdering someone and dismembering them is the time I would stop drinking. I think I would continue.
And, like, obviously they're incredibly high and drunk, and they're also acting hastily out of desperation to just get rid of the body. I feel like they're almost quite juvenile in a way that they're kind of like, if we just get rid of it and it's no longer in the flat, problem solved. They're not really thinking about what happens when the body's found and how it's going to lead back to them. Like we said, dumping Farah's remains in the canal was a stupid move. It wasn't nearly deep enough or remote enough. This is like a canal that runs through fucking Dublin city. It's not out in the middle of nowhere. And they hadn't even weighed down the bags. And what do we know happens when something starts to rot? It flows to the surface. And perhaps I think on some level, the women knew that it was a bad move because they decided to take the head somewhere else to dispose of.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. If you could wake up tomorrow and feel better about one thing in your life, what would that be? For me, it'd probably be doing less doom scrolling and worrying about things I can't control. The thing is, better can have so many different meanings based on who we are, and whether it means practicing simple daily habits to feel more positive or really digging deep about what we want to achieve in life, therapy can be a great place to start. With more than 6,000 qualified therapists across the UK, BetterHelp connects people with support that fits their needs and preferences. And if it's not the right fit, BetterHelp makes it easy to switch therapists at any time, at no extra cost. Many BetterHelp members in the UK match with a therapist in as little as 24 hours, so getting started is simpler than many people expect. Feeling better looks different for everyone. Whether you're looking to manage stress, build healthier habits, or simply check in with yourself, therapy can help you move forward. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/redhanded. That's betterhelp.com/redhanded.
I want to tell you about a new podcast that has me hooked. It's called Burden of Proof, Luigi Mangione. And it's from our friends over at ABC Audio and 2020. If you already know the story, you already know the story. In December 2024, shots rang out on a Manhattan sidewalk and UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson was shot dead. Luigi Mangione has pled guilty to federal charges. But there's so much more to this story than what unfolded on the street that day. In the new podcast, Burden of Proof, Luigi Mangione, ABC News legal analyst Brian Buckmeyer goes deep into this case and what it all means. He'll unpack the murder itself, the two men at the heart of the story, and how this case has affected the conversation about healthcare in America. Whatever you feel or think you know about the case of Luigi Mangione and Brian Thompson, this podcast will make you think more critically. Follow The Burden of Proof, Luigi Mangione, wherever you get your podcasts. Or listen ad-free on Apple Podcasts by subscribing to 2020 True Crime Plus. Again, that's Burden of Proof, Luigi Mangione.
We at Red Handed are firm believers in the power of athleisure, as everyday wear. But it's so hard to find a good sports bra that actually feels comfortable to wear all day long. You know when the strap digs in and you feel so compressed that you can hardly breathe? Well, never fear. Honeylove is here to save the day. They've just released their brand new CrossFlex activity bra. And honestly, it feels so different to any sports bra I've ever tried before. It's supportive without feeling suffocating, and it has an easy hook and eye back. Using their smart cloud-fused bonding technology to give wireless support, the heroes at Honeylove have designed a bra that actually makes sense for all-day wear. I love wearing mine to the gym, to walk the dog, even to nip into the office. Treat yourself to the most advanced bras and shapewear on the market. Use our exclusive link to save 20% off Honeylove at honeylove.com/redhanded. That's honeylove.com/redhanded. After you check out, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Experience a new standard in comfort and support with Honeylove.
They shoved the dismembered head into an old camera bag and took the bus to Tallaght and headed to the Sean Walsh Memorial Park. Here, Charlotte, the birthday girl, dug a shallow hole in the dirt beneath a park bench with her bare hands, and they buried the head. But the hole was far too small, and the head was left sticking out. Linda knew they had done a terrible job of hiding the head, and she became obsessed with it, and the idea of the head being found. I would also be concerned if I just left someone's head sticking out of the ground in a very well-trodden park in Dublin.
I'm just like, if you have gone to the effort of leaving, because they're at their mum's flat in Ballybock when they kill Farah. So they get on a bus from there all the way to Tallaght to go to this park to dispose of the head. Why don't you just dig a bit deeper? Why have you just done it enough that the head is still sticking out? I don't understand.
The paranoia continued, and over the next week, the three women kept a close eye on the canal. And on the 30th of March 2005, 10 days after they had dumped the body, and the day that Garda had been dredging the canal, was no different. As detectives and divers had worked to dig up Farah's remains, Kathleen and Linda were standing on the bridge just above, watching.
And in, like, the press photos, so, like, the news media are all obviously there. There's a fucking body in the canal. They're taking pictures of the excavation site. And when you look at those pictures, you can see Linda and Kathleen standing on the bridge, like, just above the investigators.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. So when detectives pieced the body together, they realised that the victim had suffered a ferocious attack. He had been stabbed so many times and so viciously that both his lungs had been punctured and his kidneys had been completely severed. There were also no defensive wounds on the man's arms, though examination of the skin was tough. The remains had been in the water for over a week and the skin had started to slough and slip off the muscle. But of course, the biggest issue for the Gardaí was to be identifying their victim, seeing as he was missing his head. Given this and the fact that the penis was also missing and that the victim was black, investigators began to suspect that perhaps they were dealing with some sort of ritual killing. And this wasn't that big or crazy a leap to make at the time. The torso in the Thames case had hit headlines in 2001 when the body of a young black boy, known only as Adam, was found in London. Adam had been the victim of a Mutti killing, which we're not going to go into in depth here because it's nothing to do with this case. But if you do want to know more about it, then go back and listen to our episode on Victoria Colombier. And if you're a $10 and up patron, you can also go listen to our bonus episode on the murder of people with albinism in Tanzania.
So this idea of ritual killing was a hot topic at the time, and so it became the key theory behind the body in the canal. Detectives even reached out to the African communities in Ireland, of which there are not very many, trying to see if anyone was missing. But for weeks, there were little to no leads to go on. Meanwhile, the Mulholes were drinking more, and lying the best they could. Kathleen told everyone who would listen that Farah had run off with another woman, and she told her landlord that she wanted to swap flat because there was a cockroach infestation in her flat, and that's why she'd torn up the carpets. Do cockroaches live in carpet?
This is the thing. I don't know much about cockroach infestations, but I don't know if you need to tear up strips of your carpet in order to find them. I'm not sure. I did watch a thing about a cockroach expert who said that they don't typically hang out in bedrooms. They prefer kitchens. So again, very suspect that you're tearing up the carpet in a bedroom.
Yeah, I mean, it surely makes sense that they eat human food, surely. So the kitchen is where they want to hang out.
Exactly.
It's not like they're like dust mites and they eat people.
Exactly. I think the landlord's just like, what the fuck have you done to this flat? Okay, fine. You can leave.
I've never known a landlord that would be like, yeah, sure, have another one. You've ruined this one.
Oh, yeah. And this landlord also let the residents who lived in this, like, because he buys a house. It's basically a house that he's like chopped up into flats. And he just lets all the tenants like redecorate, do whatever they want. I'm like, that's so fucking chill. Like, you couldn't even put a nail up in most places.
As the weeks passed, the Garda were getting desperate. And it was then that they got lucky. An urgent appeal was made on RTE's show called Crime Call, and €10,000 was offered up for any information as to the mystery man's identity. A Crime Stoppers poster was also circulated featuring the Ireland away football jersey that Gardaí had discovered in the canal. And finally, on the 16th of May, a Somalian man living in Dublin, Mohamed Ali Abubakar, got in touch with the Garda to say that his friend Farah Swala Noor had been missing for well over a month. He said that he'd last seen Farah on the 20th of March in town drinking with his girlfriend and her daughters, and that he'd been wearing the very same football jersey.
Mohammed also told detectives that he had been told by Kathleen Mulhall that Farah had left. But Mohammed found it odd that Farah's phone just kept going to voicemail. There was no reason that his friend would be ignoring him. And so the Gardaí checked out this lead, and they discovered that none of Farah's bank cards had been used since the day Mohammed had last seen him. Mohammed also provided another break because he pointed investigators in the direction of Paula, the Irish woman with whom Farah had had a little boy. When the Gardaí paid Paula a visit, she wasn't surprised at all. When she had seen the news about a body in the canal, she said that she had a feeling it was Farah. So she allowed detectives to take swabs from her six-year-old son, and it was discovered that the man in the canal was the boy's father. It was confirmed to be Farah Sawale Noor.
The Gardaí now decided to pay Kathleen a visit, but she denied knowing anything about any of it, and she claimed she hadn't even spoken to Farah since he'd run off. Detectives were suspicious, but they needed more. And more soon came. There's a fantastic piece of graffiti in Shoreditch at the moment that says spring soon come. It like lifts my heart every time I see it. I'll take a picture of it, put it on story. On the 11th of July at just before 8 p.m, emergency services in Dublin received a call from Wheatfield Prison. The caller claimed that he knew who had killed the man in the canal. He said the killers were his very own mum and two sisters. The man on the line was Kathleen and John Mulhall's 29-year-old son, John Mulhall Jr. He and his 33-year-old brother, who's called James, were both in Wheatfield, and they wanted to talk. When interviewed, the Mulhall brothers both claimed that their mum, Kathleen, hadn't been able to keep what had happened a secret. She had come to visit them and told them everything. Classic Catholic behaviour. Got to get it off your chest. Got to tell everyone.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that.
The guilt is worse than the thing. If I ever do anything bad, I cannot move past it until I've literally told every single person in my life what a terrible piece of shit I am.
I wonder if that is how Kathleen managed to kind of spin these plates, because I do believe that she did go and confess to John and James in prison because they know all of the details of what happened, and it certainly wasn't the sisters. But at the same time, Kathleen is also running around to people like Mohammed and everyone else she knows in Dublin saying how Farah is a piece of shit who's run off and abandoned her, like consistently. Like, she's calling people up again and again to be like, have you seen Farah? Have you heard from him? I haven't heard from him since he left. Like, she's really putting on a show.
But she's confessed, so it's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
The brothers claimed that their mum had intentionally got Charlotte and Linda drunk and high to manipulate them into murdering Farah for her. They said that they were telling the Garda everything because they were disgusted by what their family had done. And call us cynics, but it's quite possible that €10,000 reward might have had something to do with them piping up. Can you receive a reward if you are in prison?
I don't know, is the answer to that question. I do not believe that the two brothers got their hands on the €10,000, even though they do basically point the Gardaí in the direction of exactly who did it and give them all the information. And when I wrote the thing about them just doing it for the money, I did think maybe that is horribly cynical of me, because the two men, James and John, were in prison just for like traffic offences. You know, I'm not saying it's great. I think there was like reckless driving and stuff like that, but they're not like in there for having murdered somebody. And I was like, you know, maybe they were disgusted by what their mum and sisters had done. But then I did a little Google to check out where they were now to see if they'd got their hands on that reward money. Turns out in 2012, James Mulhall stabbed his girlfriend, Margaret McNamee, 12 times. She obviously went to hospital and spent 10 days in a coma. Thankfully, she survived. But James Mulhall is now very much back in prison. And this is why I'm saying I don't think that they got their hands on that money. But, like, I don't think we're being too harsh in judging them, because, again, everyone in this story is just a horrible piece of shit.
Yeah, I excuse you from the cynics court. I think it's fine.
Thank you. After they hear from John and James in prison, the very next day, the Gardaí were at flat number 117 Richmond Cottages. But if you remember, Kathleen obviously had the landlord move her into a different flat, pretending that there was a cockroach infestation. So the task of the detectives was much harder to gather forensics, because since Kathleen had moved out, two sets of tenants had passed through that property, and the flat had also been thoroughly cleaned and redecorated. However, despite all of this, investigators still found blood in the grooves of the floorboard and underneath bathroom fittings. And would you like to know a fun fact about the blood situation at this flat?
Absolutely, always. I love a fun fact, especially if it's gross.
Well, it kind of ties in what you were saying about every Irish case we ever do being like, this is the most something. This was the first time in Ireland, the first case in Ireland, in which luminol was used.
Wow, that is a good fact.
There you go. Anyway, so obviously now they've collected the blood that the women weren't able to clean up, and the Gardaí knew. They knew that their victim was Farah Sawale Noor. They knew the murder scene was flat number 117 Richmond Cottages, and their suspects looked very much like the Mulhall women. But why? And where was the head and the penis? And this is a particularly interesting twist of fate, because as far as the head is concerned, Gardaí had actually missed an opportunity to find it. Because on the 31st of March, so the very day after they had found the body bits in the canal, an elderly man who went to Sean Walsh Memorial Park every single day to read his book and smoke his pipe noticed an odd thing buried in the ground underneath a bench. And he had actually called the Gardaí to report it, even saying, quote, "It might be the head of that black fella from the canal."
That is so Irish. That is just the most Irish situation in the entire world. I love it so much.
I love it.
But by the time the Gardaí got to it, however, the head was gone. Linda had beat them to it.
Linda, we already know, had been paranoid about the head and their terrible disposal job right from the start. And after the news of the body being found hit the headlines, she decided she had to do something. So one morning, she got up, she got drunk, and she took her son's school bag to the park. A vast array of different types of bags in this. We've had gym bags, camera bags, school bags.
Yep, so many bags. And in the book by Mick McCaffrey, I'm not laughing because I think this is just such a tragic, like, little vignette into this whole story, is that Linda uses her son's school bag and her son has to use a plastic bag to go to school because his mum is using his school bag to move the head of a man that she murdered.
That's quite something. Linda takes herself off with the son's school bag and she dug up Farah's head, put it in her son's school bag and got another bus into the Dublin Mountains. During this bus journey, Linda was totally out of it, crying and begging the head in the bag for forgiveness.
She's like talking to it, saying things like, "It should have been my ma in there rather than you, Farah," which is like very odd. Like they're fully like turning on each other. It's all very like kind of Macbethy. She's now talking to this head.
Yeah, very Macbethy.
Very Shakespearean.
The head, she did a better job hiding it this time. Because to this day, Farah's head has never, ever been found. Mainly because Linda couldn't really remember exactly where she'd left it, but also because there was a lot of wild animals in them there hills, any one of which could have run off with Farah's head. Following this head-moving incident, Linda was in a bad way. She was drinking and taking drugs more than ever, if that's even possible. She said she couldn't get rid of the smell, that it clung to her, suffocating her. And then one night, after a particularly bad bender, she tried to kill herself. Her father, John, begged her to just confess. And so, finally, 2 days later, in hospital, Linda told Gardaí everything.
Soon after, Charlotte was also brought in for questioning, but she wasn't nearly as cooperative. She claimed that Linda was just lying and that it was actually Kathleen who had killed Farah. And as you can see, both the sisters are turning on their mum now because by this point, they're done with her. After suspicions had started to surface about the Mulhall's involvement in Farah's murder, Kathleen had run off to England and basically cut off all contact with her daughters. But eventually, after the Gardaí just wouldn't give up, they relentlessly questioned Charlotte. She finally confessed and corroborated everything that Linda had said. And so both Linda and Charlotte were charged with murder. When this happened, the entirety of Ireland was in shock. The idea that two relatively ordinary women could have committed such a brutal crime was beyond belief for most people. And I think that is the thing. I think it's like everybody says this most grotesque crime ever to have been committed. I think if it had been a man doing it to a woman or a man doing it to another man, I don't think it would have earned that label. I think everybody's obsessed with this case, the Scissor Sisters case. even though they're on a scissors, like we said, is because it's two women who did it.
Totally. People get so gassed when women kill men because it so rarely happens.
Oh, yeah. And it's when they kill men in a quote-unquote male way, like in quite a savagely, like, brutal way.
Yeah, women are only supposed to poison people.
So the trial kicked off in October 2006, and the whole thing was a very grisly and emotional affair. But despite their confessions and the overwhelming evidence against both of them, Charlotte and Linda both pleaded not guilty.
It didn't matter, however, and after a few days of deliberation, the jury found Charlotte guilty of murder, for which she received a mandatory life sentence. And Linda was convicted of manslaughter. She was sentenced to 15 years. The destruction of the Mulhall family didn't end there, because in December 2005, John Mulhall, scared that he would also be caught and prosecuted for his involvement in the crime, killed himself. Kathleen, who had been totally MIA for the whole of the trial, eventually came back to Dublin in February 2008. When she realised that she was going to be extradited, she was charged and given 5 years in jail.
And that's the thing about Kathleen. She doesn't come back to, like, help her daughters or support her daughters and be like, whatever happens to me, happens. She only comes back when she knows it's hopeless, when she knows that she's going to get sent back. And I feel like we have alluded to this throughout the entire case, but I do feel like it's quite a tough one to know how to feel or what to say. I think the idea that they killed this man who clearly had a long history of violence isn't that shocking. I think everyone has had like a very brutal time of it in this situation. But again, saying that, Linda and Charlotte's upbringing was definitely one that was rife with trauma and abuse and violence and substance abuse and alcohol. And one of the prosecutors actually described it as the Mulhall family had been poisoned by violence, drugs and alcohol. I do think that is a very fair point to say, because as you can see, it's kind of that trauma that I'm sure if you cared to map it back to before Kathleen and John came from their parents, came to them, and then they are, you know, not great parents, not responsible parents, their children struggle, they're neglected, they develop their own substance abuse issues. There's so many problems going on. But at the same time, that wasn't that uncommon in certain deprived communities, and not everybody horribly stabs and murders somebody to death and then dismembers them and dumps them in a canal. So it's a tough one. And also, like I said, everyone in this is so fucking awful that I'm like, it's hard to know how to feel about any of it. Obviously, Linda and Charlotte are totally out of control, and it's no excuse for what they did at all. I think it's just really sad, though, that that kind of line of trauma that has become almost hereditary in the Mulhall family has now undoubtedly been passed on to Linda's children, because once she was arrested and put in jail for 15 years, they're once again without their mother and they once again end up in care. Their grandmother's pissed off to England. Their granddad's killed himself. Like, there's no one there for them now. And I think that they are like the truest victims in this case. And what's even sadder is that Charlotte was actually pregnant during her trial. And she gave birth to a baby boy while in prison. And the baby was allowed to stay with her in the Dockhouse Centre, which is the women's prison in Mountjoy, until he was 18 months old. But again, there's another baby that's now growing up, God knows where, without a mother. And I just think it's really sad.
It is sad. And while we might not be crying any tears in any other areas of this case, specifically for Farah or any of the other Mulhalls, except the children, obviously, there are a few more victims to add to our sad little tale that we should mention. As we said, Farah's mother, wife and children are all still very much alive and living in Mombasa. Although he had left them, Farah had still been regularly sending money, and this had kept his family fed and out of complete poverty. But since his death, his family are struggling to make ends meet, with little to no money coming in at all.
So yeah, it's kind of that like ripple of trauma, neglect, substance abuse, alcoholism, and just how far the ramifications of that spread. I think this case shows that better than almost any other case we've ever talked about. So yeah, that is the story of the Scissor Sisters.
The Hammer Hermanas.
That one, because I just don't think we should call it the Scissor Sisters, because that's not what happened.
Not a scissor in sight.
Absolutely. As if it's not horrible enough, like we don't need to make up some like grisly moniker to give them. Like yeah. You can just say what they actually did and it's fucking horrible enough. But there you go, guys. That was very, very highly requested. So hopefully we did it justice for you. Hopefully you enjoyed it. If you would like a little bit of a lighter, you know, something to take the edge off, you can come hang out with us if you're a $5 and up patron on Under the Duvet immediately after this. If you're a $10 and up patron, you can even see our faces because we put it up as videos now. $5, you can listen to the audio. And I'm going to tell you something about my neck, Hannah, because I've made a discovery.
Oh.
Yeah, because you've told me you've got geek neck. Well, I can tell you about my neck.
Nerd neck. Thank you very much. We only do alliteration in my house.
Nerd neck. Sorry. Nerd neck. Okay. Well, I've also got a neck. And I have discovered it recently, so I'll tell you about it on Under the Duvet. So, here are some lovely people who have signed up to our Patreon at some point, so we need to say thank you to them. So, thank you, Justina Snyder, Kayla Murphy, Presley, Andrew Chiala, Claire Holland, Nicole Stewart W, Maggie Kuma, Emily Inglis, Sara C. Gaddis, Kwali Dubar, Celia Steinberger, Sinead Dean, Hannah Braun, Ty Grande, Melissa McKnight, Lara, Emily Karam, Maggie Schaefer, Emma Palmer, Ella, Cara Hindley, Heather Wallace, Tone, Kate McIntosh, Stephanie Kay, Alexandra Jones, Rebecca Heron, Aisha Mohammed, Kaylee, there you go. Jennifer, Annie and Lauren, Natalie Bosch, Megan Ochoa,
Christine Weiss, Alyssa George, Ms. Boom, Joseph Coleman, Milica Christofic, Christina Molly, Matilica, Vanessa Hannah, get a grip. Two N's though, Vanessa Jones, Elizabeth Cole, Mackenzie Tyshuk, Megan Hook, Sierra Howard, Adrian G, Kristen King, Laura Kate Brown, Stacey Wolf, Emily Burnett, Josie Cayley, Lottie Gore, Alexandra Morrow, Laura Flynn, Sammy Marshall, Alicia Burness, Rachel Howard, Lewith Malith, Jock Deng, Brittany Marino, Matty Snook, Maya Akras, Petra Helena, Frederica Stockasira, Jesus Christ, leave some names for the rest of us, Miss Emma Legg, Saul Lopez, Pixie Thackray, Abby Sheridan, Megan McNulty, Sean Sloan Dennison, Abigail Hodgson, Pixie... Oh, we've done Pixie. Abby Sher. Yep, we've done those.
Oh, you've done all of them. There you go.
Done all of them. Sean was our last one. Thank you to everyone. And especially Sean Sloan Dennison, because I think you've got a great name.
Absolutely.
But the rest of you, I'm sure, are very nice as well.
Wonderful. Thank you all so much. And goodbye.
Bye. See you something time, sometime. Bye.
Your vehicle doesn't just get you from here to there. It's a bridge to the people and places that matter most. It's how you show up for your family, your community, and everyone else that depends on you. That's why for 125 years, Firestone has been building tires with one thing in mind: to deliver products that are as reliable as you are. Firestone, always dependable since 1900.
Hey, let's talk about something a lot of us deal with: thinning hair or hair loss. If that sounds familiar, CAPS has solutions. Their hair restoration treatments are personalized, designed to strengthen your existing hair, encourage regrowth, and improve scalp health. The providers at CAPS guide you every step of the way with advanced treatments for noticeable, long-lasting results. And when you book your first hair restoration appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.